Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Credit journalism. With the appointment of a special counsel yesterday to get to the bottom of the Trump campaign and Russia. If you think about it, it was the Washington Post that revealed that Jeff Sessions gave a false statement at his confirmation hearing about having contact with the Russians during the campaign. That forced Sessions to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, which allowed Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to make the decision to appoint a special counsel on his own. And it was the New York Times revelation of the James Comey memo alleging Trump tried to get him to cancel the Flynn investigation that was Rosenstein's last straw. Without the Times, without the Post, without the First Amendment and independent journalism, Trump and his circle might be getting away with anything they want. It was also the Times that broke the story of Trump giving classified information from Israel to the Russians last week, forcing his aides to notify the intelligence community that they needed to do damage control. How will the scandal and the leak to the Russians affect Trump's trip to the Middle East, including Israel and Europe, which begins tomorrow? Did it have anything to do with Trump's decision yesterday, getting remarkably little attention, to stay in the Iran nuclear deal for now? Yesterday was the deadline for lifting certain sanctions on Iran, and Trump did abide by the terms. We'll talk about these developments and more now with our first guest today, CNN's chief international correspondent, Christian Amanpour, who joins us from London. Hi, Christian. Thanks so much. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's so good to be with you.
So I see you gave the commencement address at Northeastern University in Boston this month, and you called on the graduates to resist the assault on truth by world leaders who label inconvenient facts as fake news. Were you talking about more than just Donald Trump?
Yes, of course. I was talking about Donald Trump and many, many, many others around the world who I have covered and many of our colleagues cover on a daily basis, who simply, you know, there are two types of fake news, the type that is actually made out of whole cloth, and then there's the type that certain leaders decide is a code name for this is what I don't like you to say about me. So we just have to be on our guard, and I do think that journalism can hold up its head and be proud that it has been reawakened in the last several months and is doing a heck of a good job doing its job. Nothing heroic, nothing grand, nothing political, just its job. And that is our job.
I see you wrote an article in the Columbia Journalism Review that cited countries like Turkey under their strongman Erdogan, which has the highest number of journalists behind bars. And you saw some of Trump's rhetoric since the election and even during the campaign, partly in that light.
You know, I've been writing about the freedom of journalists to operate, both just be able to, you know, have free speech and free expression, as well as the freedom to be safe and not to be targeted. And my whole career as an international correspondent has been in some of the most dangerous places in the world, which are dangerous deliberately for journalists. These are countries where their leaders come after journalists deliberately, or militants, or these sort of nefarious groups. So it's something that I've been steeped in for a long, long time, and it's something that I'm very, very careful about, very conscious of, and I'm constantly, whenever I have the opportunity to interview an Erdogan or a Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, or if I had the opportunity to interview the president of Mexico or the president of the United States or any other presidents who take it out on journalists, in other words, the whole metaphor, killing the messenger, shooting the messenger, then I bring it up with them over and over again. I mean, yesterday you saw an appalling scene in Washington outside the Turkish embassy.
I was just going to ask, yes. And not getting enough attention.
Well, I mean, goons beating up either protesters or journalists who are trying to do their job of covering what's going on in the heart of, you know, the American capital, the heart of democracy.
And I saw the video. It was Erdogan's personal security guards charging past D.C. police to beat up some of the protesters.
Well, you know, I mean, it goes without saying it's an outrage. This is not the first time it's happened. It's happened before when President Erdogan has visited the United States. In fact, it happened around the time I interviewed him, and I can't remember how many years, but it was a couple of years ago. And I asked him in that interview, why are you so thin-skinned? Why is it you just don't allow us to ask you these questions, or allow, frankly, your own journalists just to be journalists? You call yourself a democracy. Because sometimes when you bring attention to the kinds of things you do and you complain about the things you do, you make it worse for yourself.
At Northeastern, you described the main theme of your journalism career as my long struggle against normalizing deviance. What did you mean by normalizing deviance?
Well, what I mean is that I don't accept this, for want of a better construction, new normal that everybody keeps saying at the drop of a hat, whatever it might be. You know, terrorism in the heart of our capitals, the new normal. You know, crises in the top of power, the new normal. Journalists being called fake news, the new normal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't accept that. I mean, you know, you have to hold a line. And if we're not going to do it, who's going to do it? Obviously, there are many, many institutions in the United States and across our democratic world that are tasked with holding the line, no matter where it is, in justice, in the legal, in journalism, in human rights, all of those things. And I guess what I was saying to these students was there will be times when you are faced with, you know, the expediency of going along to get along, or of making sure that you face up to some of these challenges and understand how and when to hold the line.
I see you interviewed Condoleezza Rice the other day, President Bush's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, and people may forget her original expertise was Russia. Did you ask about Trump Circle and their web of Russia connections and how that looks to her?
I did. And obviously, I've been asking a lot of people. I had Condoleezza Rice on. I had Leon Panetta. And a lot of people, as I say, I like to interview on my show the real players, people who've got this depth and breadth of experience and information and come at it from, you know, the kind of angles that we seek to explore right now. She obviously told me that she's horrified at the notion that Russia could have interfered in America's democratic institutions. Her new book is about democracy, and she's clearly incredibly passionate about not just democracy in our world, but about America standing up for and promoting democracy. So she's very, very passionate about it. And being a Russia expert, she's equally passionate and vociferous about any challenge to that democracy and any tampering with it. And as we know, it's not just the United States where that's alleged to have happened. We saw it happening in the just held French elections, in the run-up to those elections. We know it's been happening in many other European countries, including Germany. Now, Germany, and, well, France for sure, has bucked this sort of populist, fake news, nationalist trend. And they stuck with the center, they stuck with the global, with the open, with the tolerant, outward-looking, and they elected Emmanuel Macron. And it looks like Angela Merkel, who is also now the main leader in Europe, is set and on her way to a fourth election victory.
CNN's chief international correspondent Christiane Amanpour with us. What do you make of Trump deciding yesterday to stay in the Iran nuclear deal and provide the sanctions relief that yesterday was a deadline for?
I'm not surprised. Both his State Department and the administration, this comes up every 6 months. They have to see whether Iran is abiding by the terms of the nuclear deal and decide whether or not to keep the sanction waiver. In other words, keep off the sanctions that were attached to that deal. Other sanctions remain, as you know, for other things like missile infractions and other such things. But when it comes to the ones that were under the nuclear deal, they have continued to waive those sanctions, and I'm really not surprised about it. I'm not saying that he'll stick with that for the foreseeable future, but I can tell you that that is going to be a huge part of the conversations the president has with the king of Saudi Arabia, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the prime minister of Israel, and all the sort of Gulf and Arab leaders he's going to be meeting this next weekend and over the next few days. And then, because they will want, you know, to isolate Iran. Then, at the end of the week, he goes on to the NATO summit and to the G7 of his Western alliance partners, and they will want exactly the opposite, for the United States to keep inside the Iran nuclear deal and not to rip it up and not to reimpose sanctions. So, you know, he's going to be pulled between those two poles.
One of the things about the Trump trip that begins tomorrow is that he'll visit the centers of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, Jerusalem, the Vatican, and Saudi Arabia, where Mecca is. Does that strike you as different from past presidents' trips or goal-oriented, not just symbolic?
Well, I think this one is going to have them all on one trip. If you remember, President Obama's trip was to the Middle East, but he didn't go to Israel on that first trip. He made that big speech in Egypt and then on to Turkey, and I think that caused a lot of sort of upset in Israel. And I don't think President Obama went to the Vatican at that time either, although he has been. But I think that this, you know, they're making a point here. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we can get all those Abrahamic faiths together in love and peace? I think it's going to be a lot more complicated than anybody imagines. But it's going to be important to set foot and touch down in these areas. I mean, the fact of the matter is the president is going to allied countries, partners, certainly in the Middle East and Israel, who want to see him do well, who I've been told, certainly in Saudi Arabia, will roll out a red carpet, the pile of which you've never before seen, as was described for me. They're desperate to make this a massive success. They'll announce all sorts of billions of dollars of investment in the United States, arms purchases, etc. But the key is, obviously, what President Trump also wants to do, as he said, is achieve the ultimate deal, and that is bring Israel and the Palestinians to a peace accord. That is going to be much, much, much more difficult.
So the last time you were on, you may remember, you recommended that my listeners and I see the play Oslo at Lincoln Center about the Oslo Peace Accords. I did take you up on that, Christian, and it was really great, and we had the playwright on the air. So thank you.
I'm so pleased.
But here we are more than 15 years after the Oslo process basically disintegrated, and Trump is about to visit Jerusalem and take his own stab at that, as you say. What, if anything, do you think is left of that process that he can build on if he's got the skills to do it?
Well, the framework of the process is left. That's the only thing in place between Israel and the Palestinians. The only thing governing, a lack of all-out war is still the framework of the Oslo Accords. And you have a Palestinian authority, an official Palestinian authority, as it's called, with a president that was established under the Oslo Accords. And you have mechanisms on that side, certainly in the Palestinian arena and obviously in the democratic Israel, that already existed. But you have these mechanisms upon which you can build if you care to. But of course, the intervening years have made it terribly complicated. You have the rise of Hamas, and Condoleezza Rice, by the way, is very self-critical and critical of her own administration by pushing those democratic elections in the Palestinian territories in 2006 against the advice of the Israelis, against the advice even of the Palestinian Authority that brought us Hamas. Hamas now rules Gaza and is very strong in the West Bank as well. So that's a complication. Hamas is a complication. And on the Israeli side, continued settlement building is a massive complication. And the extreme right-wing additions to Prime Minister Netanyahu's government is a huge complication. Whether President Trump can bridge that divide, it remains to be seen. Some have said he comes without a plan, and that's a good thing.
Could be, and he has spoken about, well, the deal he wants to see is the deal that the two sides can agree to. The classified secrets about ISIS that Trump shared with Russia last week have been reported as secrets from Israel. How, if at all, do you think that complicates the Israel part of Trump's trip or intelligence sharing in general with Israel, which gathers a lot of important intelligence that the U.S. doesn't?
You know, it's hard to tell. I'm sure there are different sort of moods between the political Israel and military intelligence security Israel. I'm sure, you know, the latter are beside themselves that this kind of intelligence was shared, if indeed it was. And the politicians are trying probably to put the best face they possibly can on it. And as you know, they have been mum. I mean, we haven't heard a single word from any official Israeli government minister or current serving military intelligence leader on this issue. And, you know, as one would expect. So it's hard to tell, but it is. We've heard that it is going to be more difficult for governments, allies, etc., to be as forthcoming as they might be.
Last thing, what do you think it'll be like with Trump and Pope Francis at the Vatican, considering the Pope's advocacy on behalf of refugees and immigrants?
Well, I think it'll be difficult, and I think the Pope will make his views absolutely clear. He's already said it. He's not going to prejudge until he meets the president. But I hear that the meeting is short at the Pope's insistence. That's what I hear from a source. But he's going to be polite. He's going to meet a head of state who's been elected. And no doubt, as he does to all his interlocutors, the Pope is going to listen, and he's also going to put across the moral imperative, the imperative when it comes to, you know, basic humanity, when he meets President Trump. But, you know, people are not going to be able to get over the fact that President Trump comes amid these massive domestic crises. And, you know, Robin Wright of The New Yorker has written a major article reminding everybody that 45 years ago, Richard Nixon, in the midst of Watergate, made this kind of trip, and even to some of the same countries in the Middle East. So, you know, you've got the possibility of a good trip, but you've got all this crisis around it as well. It's confusing and complicated.
Christiane Amanpour, CNN's chief international correspondent and host of Amanpour Daily on CNN. Thank you so much. Any more theater tips?
I'll let you know.
So when you're in
New York next time,
when you're in New York, Christiane, you should see Sweat, about a town in Pennsylvania.
I did.
You did.
Oh, I did.
won the Pulitzer Prize up
I
for
know it did.
Best Play for the Tonys. Of course, as you know, about a town in Pennsylvania that loses its main employer to Mexico.
It's brilliant, actually. It's a brilliant riff on Trump voters.
We're giving away Hamilton tickets on the station today. Sweat and Oslo, people can actually buy tickets too. Christiane, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.